TheYeshiva.net.
Well, welcome, everybody. Rabbi Siegel, meet Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson.
Nice to meet you.
Pleasure and honor to be with you.
Dr. Siegel. Okay, so we are going to give me a moment. I'm just going to sort of welcome everybody, start this off, and then we'll jump right into the conversation. So welcome, everybody, and thank you again for joining us today. As I've said now the other nine times, but there's always new people listening. My name is Yochanan Poulter. I'm co-founder and executive director of Fresh Start, and it's a true honor and zchus for us to have hosted this webinar series, bringing together Jews from all over the world and all different backgrounds. Dr. Siegel, this is the final in a 10-part webinar series that really brought together Jews from literally all over the world. And in times of times like these, it was very meaningful for us to be able to be a uniting front, and it's been an incredible experience. When Fresh Start opened a few years ago, our goal was to provide services and programming to help Klal Yisrael hear from the past, including childhood abuse, trauma, and neglect. But of course, things are a little different in the world, and a lot of the trauma we're experiencing today is live and real within our bodies. And we hope this webinar series will help all of us and our families navigate through these times. And I think it's auspicious and appropriate, Dr. Siegel, that we are finishing off. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about the trauma, and it'll be nice to end talking about the healing and the mindfulness and the ability to create, you know, beauty in our lives. To learn more about Fresh Start, please visit jewishfreshstart.com. I would like to again thank our anonymous sponsor who graciously sponsored this entire series, Le'iluya Nishmas, Daniel Ben Esther, Rafal Ben Leah, Mary Yehuda Ben Yosef Akayan, and in honor of Tzedek Eliyahu and Ellie Seligson, two true pillars of the Detroit community. Joining us today again, we have the schus of having Rabbi Y.Y. Thank you, Rabbi Y.Y., for once again being part of this incredible program. We are also joined by Mrs. Tova Korn, co-founder and program director of Fresh Start. And it's an honor to welcome Dr. Ron Siegel. For those who don't know, Dr. Siegel is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, where he has taught for over 35 years, a longtime student of mindfulness and meditation. He serves on the board of directors and faculty of the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy. He teaches internationally about mind and body and the application of mindfulness and compassion practices in psychotherapy and other fields. He has co-authored and authored dozens of books on the topic, and he is considered a world-renowned expert on the topic. Dr. Ron, as we talked earlier today, this is going to be a flowing discussion. We're excited about where it's going to go. As Rabbi Y.Y. said, we encourage everybody to please join in the conversation. If you have a question, let us know in the Q&A. We're going to do our best to bring in some live questions. But that being said, Rabbi Y.Y., why don't you lead us off and start this conversation?
Yeah. First of all, it's an honor to be here, and a very great privilege. So I think what we would love to get out of, at least part of what we would love to get out of this evening's discussion and conversation, is really genuine tools for each of us to be able to connect every single day, let's say, to our soul or to our innermost core, to that dimension inside each of us, which we know is whole and connected and clear, has clarity and has inner confidence and strength. It's very easy during everybody's life, everyone with their own challenges and burdens and duties, and never mind traumas and pain and anxiety and concerns and worry and fear, to get derailed so easily, especially in today's era where everybody's connected to everybody else's news and experience. So it's even very hard to get your own time. The tradition many of us grew up in, which is, of course, the Jewish tradition, particularly I grew up in the Hasidic spiritual tradition, puts an enormous emphasis on what some of the great mystics call in Hebrew hitbonenut or hitbodedut, which is spending time in contemplation, meditation, what today they call mindfulness, what you call mindfulness, to be able to connect to your own inner awareness, to be able to listen to your own inner voice, your soul's voice, not just a voice of anxiety and chaos. And it's a sustained effort. Judaism encourages a daily sustained effort of meditation 3 times a day, morning, evening, and the afternoon. It encourages gratitude every single day, numerous times, even before we eat something, coming out of the bathroom, before you go to sleep, right when you wake up in the morning. So, you know, thankfully, in our culture and tradition and faith, there is a huge emphasis on this. But I think all of us can use the tools and techniques to be able to really make it part of our lives, to really integrate it into our lives. And practically, you know, on a moment-to-moment basis or day-to-day basis, know what to do and how to behave and what we can each do to enhance our own well-being, our children's well-being, create homes and environments that are radiating happiness, confidence, faith, spirituality, love, light, positivity, and empowerment, and as really a way of showing up to life with our best version, showing up to our loved ones with our best version, and whatever our responsibilities are in this world to make it a better place, to fight injustice, to call out lies, to cultivate light and positivity, to be able to show up with our deepest and most authentic self. So here we have the expert, Dr. Siegel. God bless you. Hopefully to be able to help us with this journey.
Well, while I do have a lot of years working in this field and practicing mindfulness, it is a practice. And as a Zen master, Suzuki Roshi, famously said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So I'm not sure I'll go with the expert label. I'd rather try to have a beginner's mind here, but I can share with you something of what I and my colleagues and researchers and the world's wisdom traditions have had to say about mindfulness practices and how they might be useful. So, you know, mindfulness refers to a certain attitude toward experience. It's a way of relating to each moment of our lives, whatever might be, emerging in that moment, whether it be an emotion, a thought, whether we're involved in an interpersonal, interaction with somebody, whether we're involved in prayer or contemplation. And it's about cultivating an attitude in which we're aware and conscious of what's happening. So there's a kind of sensitivity to everything that's happening in the body, in the senses, in the mind, in the inner imaginal world. So it's about awareness of what's happening in the moment with an attitude of loving acceptance. And that second part sounds easy, but actually isn't so easy because we're very much in the habit. In fact, it seems to be in the nature of our brains to tend to reject and pull away from things that are painful or difficult or uncomfortable and gravitate toward or trying to cling to or hold on to that which is pleasurable. And all other species do this as well. You could see it has enormous survival value. I mean, obviously, you know, to learn to take your hand away from the hot stove or eat delicious food is going to be good for our survival. But it's actually problematic in a lot of realms, because what we wind up doing is shutting down on broad swaths of our emotional experience. And it winds up making us less present, because whenever we shut down on, pull away from, or avoid one experience or another, we're less able to show up to whatever's happening in this moment. And we're less able to show up to one another, because often what happens among human beings, You know, sometimes it's warm and lovely and loving, but sometimes it's difficult, or sometimes people we love are sharing their pain or they're in pain. And so mindfulness practice is really about mindfulness is this attitude toward experience, this attitude of open acceptance toward whatever is arising here and now in our consciousness. And to develop mindfulness, we do mindfulness practices, not unlike the realm of cultivating physical skills. You know, if we want to develop physical fitness, which is sort of strength, endurance, and flexibility, well, we would do physical exercise. We'd go to the gym or go for a walk or do things to develop that. So in the same way, to develop this open and loving attitude toward experience, we do practices. And these practices, interestingly, have been developed in virtually all of the cultures of the world. As the rabbi was just saying, they exist in Jewish traditions. They exist in Christian traditions. They exist in Muslim traditions, in Buddhist traditions, in yogic traditions. They exist in more animistic indigenous cultures. That people have discovered that it takes some training of the heart and the mind to be able to be with experience in an open way, rather than just push away that which is unpleasant and just cling toward that which is pleasant. And also rather than getting caught in the thought stream, which most of us do much of the time. We spend our days thinking and talking to ourselves about ourselves. But when we do that, we don't have the opportunity both to fully show up for what's happening in the moment, even to fully taste a meal for that matter, because we're planning the next thing and thinking about it. But also being in the thought stream makes it difficult to actually notice what we might be feeling underneath, what, you know, as the rabbi was saying, to connect with deeper parts of ourselves, to connect with wisdom and to connect with feelings that otherwise we might push out of awareness because they're difficult. So mindfulness is this attitude toward experience, and mindfulness practices are these ways to develop this. And this matters always in our lives, but it particularly matters when we're challenged, when we're going through emotionally hard times. I know you've been talking a lot about trauma in this series, and, you know, very broadly, we can think of trauma as moments in which the ratio or the relationship between our felt capacity to bear something difficult and the intensity of the thing itself is such that we're overwhelmed and we're blocking it out. And that can be very different for different people. It could, you know, for one person, it could be traumatic to have to do public speaking when they're afraid of that, and they get flooded with anxiety. Of course, there are other traumas, like some that are occurring in the world right now, where god-awful things are happening to people and their lives are being uprooted. And of course, for almost all of us, those kinds of emotional challenges are overwhelming. But the interesting thing is that there's two factors here. There's, on the one hand, the intensity of the difficult experience, and on the other hand, there's our capacity to bear that, our capacity to open to it, our capacity to have the courage to feel what we feel. And, you know, oftentimes we're in situations where we can't really control the intensity of the experience. Something's happening in the world, something's happening in our lives that is not something that we can control. But we can cultivate this ability to open to it and to tolerate it and to be interested in it and to explore whatever's happening in the experience and to find the meaning that might be in what's happening.
So in a very practical sense, a couple are sitting down to talk, a husband and a wife. And the husband says something, and the wife says something, and the other person is triggered. They're angry, they're upset, they're frustrated, their emotions are all over the place. You know, they would like to fight, flight, freeze, fawn, whatever it is. Guide us.
Okay, that's a great example, and one that happens quite regularly for anybody who lives in a family, for example. what we want to do in a moment like that is to take a moment to notice what's actually going on inside of us. And this is a lot of what we do. You know, when we develop mindfulness and when we do mindfulness practices, they're typically meditation practices that we do. So before the moment of the argument, we might be taking some time in our lives, as you were suggesting, in some traditions it's three times a day, but at some point during the day, to spend time noticing what's happening here and now. And why don't I lead everybody in a brief practice, just for a flavor of what we're talking about. And then we can talk about how to apply that in a situation like the one that you're suggesting. So if you're comfortable allowing your eyes to close, do that. But otherwise, you can leave your eyes open and just with a kind of soft gaze, and find a comfortable and alert posture. This is just because it makes it easier to be awake and to pay attention. And let's just take a few moments to notice what's happening here and now inside. And if at any point this starts to feel overwhelming or too much, and if you're in the midst of a crisis, that can easily happen, really feel free to open your eyes and discontinue this. It's just if you're in a situation where you are feeling safe enough, just allow yourself to notice what's happening in the body. Notice the contact between the feet and the floor, the backs of your legs and your back and the chair. And just begin to shift your attention from thinking about things to feeling what's happening here and now in the body. And you'll notice that if all is going well, you're already breathing. In fact, the body is breathing itself. The breath is moving all by itself. And all that we're going to do for a couple of minutes here is just gently bring the attention out of the stream of thought into noticing what's happening here and now in the body. And if it's comfortable for you, using the breath as an anchor, just the sensations of breathing. And see if you might follow the breath through its full cycles, from the beginning of an in-breath to that point of relative fullness to the end of an out-breath, and then on to the next in-breath. Just beginning to pay attention to the moment-to-moment sensations here and now. It would not be unusual for thoughts to enter the mind. That's okay. We're not trying to get rid of thoughts. But instead of doing what we normally would do, which would be to follow a train of thought when it starts entering the mind, as soon as you notice that the attention has left the breath and other bodily sensations, just gently and lovingly see if you can redirect the attention to the sensations of breathing, to the sensations of the body here and now. You may notice there's a lot going on, that there are a lot of different sensations with each in-breath and out-breath. And see if you can cultivate an attitude of loving acceptance toward whatever's happening, as though we're actually all okay. You may notice emotions are present. That's okay. We're just going to allow them to be as they are. And simply notice the emotion as a sensation in the body. And then gently come back to the breath. We're taking refuge in the present moment. Hopefully here and now, wherever you are, no matter what else is happening in the world or has happened or will happen, here and now, we're actually safe in this particular moment. And we're just opening to whatever's happening in our consciousness. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes again if they've been closed and bring your attention back out. And you may notice a few things from that very brief exercise. One thing you might notice is there are a lot of sensations going on. There's a lot happening in each moment. Here and now. Another thing you might notice is there are a lot of thoughts, right? That the mind is, you know, thoughts are constantly emerging and coming and going. And when we practice this at greater length, sooner or later, usually feelings come up, pleasant ones, unpleasant ones. Sensations come up, some of which are pleasant and some of which are unpleasant. Sometimes there are things like aches and pains. And what we learn to do over time with these practices is allow all of this. Instead of immediately trying to do something to fix it, to make it go away, to change it, we turn our attention to whatever's arising in our awareness and try to stay with it and breathe with it a bit. So to come back to Rabbi, to your question of what to do in the midst of the argument, when we're starting to trigger one another and escalating into a big something that started as nothing and is becoming the kind of discussion that can ruin your whole day. What we wind up doing is just taking a moment to go inward a little bit and notice, so what is this feeling here? What's happening? Is it fear that's arising in the body as my partner or spouse says something that's threatening to me? Is it sadness? Is it longing? If it's anger, what's the anger all about? And what's part of the anger? Is there fear that's part of the anger? Is that where it's coming from? Because what happens as we practice mindfulness is we become much more sensitized to the full realm of what's happening psychologically and physically at each moment. And we also gain practice in not feeling compelled to immediately do something to fix it. So a wave of anger can come up, for example, but we have some practice in not necessarily starting to act angrily. There's an acronym we use in the psychotherapy world, which is WAIT, W-A-I-T, and it stands for why am I talking? To take a moment and ask ourselves, really, is this useful here? My wife was talking to my cousin-in-law, if you will, who's very good at waiting. He's very good at this kind of self-restraint. And they came up with a subsequent acronym, which is BLURT, which is better left unsaid, comma, really try. That there are these moments where we realize it's not going to be helpful to just go with the impulse.
There was a great Hasidic master, the Baal Shem Tov. He was one of the greatest spiritual masters in Judaism. So he said, when you're angry, you should be quiet for 61 minutes.
Yeah.
Not 60 minutes. Yeah. 61 minutes.
Yeah, no, totally. Well, it's an interesting misconception people have about anger. People who act angrily a lot are actually not very good at feeling anger. Because what happens for people who act angrily a lot is whenever they have anger arising in the heart and the mind, they immediately express it. And that expression is really a way of trying to discharge it and get rid of it. People who have developed skill, like the Baal Shem Tov or perhaps a mindfulness master, who've developed skill at being with anger, know how to feel it vividly, because you feel it much more vividly if you don't immediately express it.
So what you're suggesting is that when we include this into our lifestyle, what happens is we can get to the more authentic underlying emotion,
yeah,
rather than the external facade.
Yeah, because anger is rare. Anger is rarely just anger. I mean,
it's a secondary emotion.
Yeah, exactly.
This husband and wife are arguing. Let's say a parent and a child. You know, the father or the mother are triggered by this child. I don't know. Maybe they're feeling angry or overwhelmed or very upset or frustrated. And, you know, and they want to just either run away or lash out. So if the parents, father, mother, can practice a little mindfulness at that moment, so they experience what they're feeling, and what's the next step?
Well, one of the things that we notice, and this is a great insight that comes from this practice, and you get the insight more if you practice more. So if you sit down for 20 minutes or so and investigate the heart and the mind this way, is we notice that everything changes. It's consciousness is constantly fluid. You know, so often when we feel anxious or angry or sad, we have the fantasy and the fear that it's somehow going to last forever and we've got to do something to fix it. What you discover in mindfulness practice is an awful lot of experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant experiences, just continue to change by themselves. So you can be with physically an itch or an ache, sit with it, bring attention to it. Oftentimes it'll transform. And certainly in the emotional realm, if we can open to a wave of fear, if we can open to a wave of sadness, if we can open to the experience of anger, not feel compelled to do something about it, but just stay with it, very often it transforms by itself. And this gives us This is really transformative for us because it starts to give us much more courage in the world. If we think about what we're afraid of in the world, I'll just speak for myself. When I think about what I'm afraid of in the world, you know, something bad happening to my wife or my kids, some embarrassing or failure experience in my career, a medical problem, there's kinds of things like this. You know, what I'm really afraid of is I'm really afraid that it's going to make me feel bad. It's going to make me anxious or it's going to make me sad or something. And I'm afraid that that feeling is going to last forever somehow, as though I were going to last forever. Such an assumption, right? And it's that fear of being stuck in enduring, unresolvable pain that winds up making us feel like we've got to do something compulsively to fix the situation. And I'm not suggesting that we don't fix things that can be fixed. You know, obviously we're going to take action when there's a problem that can be solved, but the solvable problems aren't the ones that vex us. The ones that vex us are the ones where there isn't an easy solution and we become afraid of the feeling that's connected to it. When you practice mindfulness a bunch, you get to actually see, okay, so what are emotions exactly? Start to notice that, well, there are these body sensations. Here, I'll do another little exercise with everybody. I think it'll illustrate this. So let's take another moment to close your eyes. Don't do this if you're driving, by the way, the close your eyes part. Close your eyes gently and take a breath or two. And now just generate a little bit of sadness. Please don't pick something overwhelming or that's too much, but just something that creates a little bit of sadness. And just notice the sensations of sadness in the body. Notice where it lives. And you can even, if you're comfortable doing this, put a hand over the part of your body where you feel the sadness. Just breathe with it and feel it a little bit. And just notice it as a body sensation. And feel it in the body. And then let's shift and generate a little bit of anxiety. Again, not the scariest thing ever, please. Just something that makes you a little worried. And notice how anxiety feels in the body. Where that shows up. And just breathe with that a little bit. And maybe put your hand over the part of your body where you feel that. Just to identify it a little more clearly. And then generate a little bit of annoyance or anger. Again, not something huge, but just something that's a little bit annoying. And notice where you feel annoyance or anger. And maybe put your hand over that part of your body. And breathe with that. And just to add in positive emotions, also let yourself generate a little bit of joy. Feel a little bit of joy and notice where that's occurring in the body. And maybe place your hand over that part of your body. And when you're done, you can gently open your eyes and come back again. You notice how all of these emotions exist as sensations in the body, right? We can actually feel them in the body. One of the things that we learn to do with mindfulness practice is when emotions arise, to stay with them at the level of the body, to just stay, let me just be with that. And as you were saying, Rabbi, before about, you know, how often something's a secondary emotion and you can find out the component emotions. When we just stay with it in this way, and particularly when we're able to stay with it as it manifests in the body, it will reveal itself. Very often we see the associations, the thoughts, the images. We see the other things that are part of this. And we see that it changes all by itself if we only pay attention to it in a loving way and give ourselves permission to feel things. So in a broad way, mindfulness practices help us to have a particular relationship to our whole emotional life in which feelings come and go and can arise and pass much more freely than they often do when we get stuck in trying to control them or fight them, or when we get stuck in our stories about them that can keep them fixed.
What about when the person, if I or somebody is focusing on all these emotions and a major part of the emotions or the thought is a lot of self-blame and self-hate and self-loathing? And so it's like a vicious cycle. Like you say, you're in a conversation with yourself, the inner mental chatter. And even as you're trying to focus on that, the mental chatter is, oh, so now you're focusing.
Yeah.
So that itself becomes part of the mental chatter.
Well, excellent point. That's a good illustration of how when we get on a self-critical riff, we can do it about absolutely anything and everything. And it's really the it has little to do with reality. It's just this tendency to be self-critical.
The inner bully will use anything
24/7
to bully you.
Yeah, it's very interesting in the history of mindfulness practices in the psychology world. In the early days, the emphasis was on learning how to pay attention, to be more aware, to be more conscious moment to moment of what's happening, to be more rooted in the present moment. As the research has accumulated and people's experience with it has accumulated over many decades, it's become much clearer that the self-compassion component, the loving attitude toward experience turns out to be enormously important. A lot of people when they, so I'm a psychotherapist by training. And, you know, when people enter psychotherapy, the secret wish is often to get a whole new personality. You know, oh, I'm going to get into therapy and I won't have to be Ron anymore with all of Ron's neurotic preoccupations, with all of Ron's fears. I'll be able to be like those other people who are strong, who are confident, who are competent and the like. And what happens when psychotherapy goes well is at the end of therapy, we're very much still ourselves, only we've made friends with this person and we see this complex and flawed and lovable human being as a complex, flawed, and lovable human being. And we start to relate to ourselves that way. So so part and parcel of mindfulness practices is really developing a kind of compassionate attitude toward ourselves and to find a different way to relate to this inner critic, because so many of us are in a crit. I mean, we'll talk to ourselves in a way we'd never talk to another human being. You know, I have no trouble at all saying, "You idiot, what were you thinking?" I don't talk to friends and colleagues that way. If I did, I wouldn't have friends and colleagues, right? But no problem talking to myself that way. Well, bit by bit, we start to develop self-compassion. And there, it's actually been studied in the psychology world, and there are certain components to sort of self-criticism versus self-compassion. When we're being down on ourselves, when we feel we've screwed up, when we feel like we're inadequate or we haven't done well enough or we're not doing well enough, we get caught in kind of three things. We get caught in the self-criticism where we talk to ourselves, you know, in very mean ways. We tend to withdraw. We tend to isolate, you know, because we feel bad about ourselves. We feel shame. And shame is kind of about not wanting to be part of the human family or not feeling fit to be part of the human family. So we kind of withdraw. And we get very self-preoccupied, right? We're focused on what a failure we are, how inadequate we are, how bad we are, and all this kind of self-critical, all these negative self-evaluative judgments about ourselves. And the alternative to this is to deliberately look for self-kindness, right? To deliberately look for common humanity instead of the isolation. What do I mean by common humanity? It's realizing we all make mistakes. We are all flawed. We are all scared. We are all sad. We are all heartbroken. These are aspects of the human condition. These aren't because of my personal failings. This is what it is to be embodied as a human being. And instead of being caught in the narrative about ourselves, we practice more mindfulness. And one of the key elements of mindfulness where, and even in these brief practices that we just did, where we're shifting the attention from the narrative thought stream to what's happening moment to moment at a sensory level, that begins to give us a little bit of perspective on thoughts. Psychologists call this metacognitive awareness, the ability to see that a thought is a thought rather than a reality. And the more we practice mindfulness, the more we have this perspective on thought and we take it a bit less seriously and we'll be able to be kinder to ourselves. And guess what? We wind up being much kinder to other people because we wind, you know, when other people screw up, which they do regularly, we realize, oh, like me, you know, I get it. You mess up the same way I mess up. We're in this together and we start to rely on connection and on the sense of common humanity much more so than on the constant self-evaluative narrative.
So correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm understanding what you're saying and some other things you shared at other times, is a major part of mindfulness the deep recognition that the I, the inner I, is in a very, very powerful place. The inner I is not made up of my thoughts and of my toxic inner critic and of all of the emotions or thoughts that may be very negative or fearful or overwhelming or full of hate and anxiety, but that there is an inner I that is what we would call in our tradition the divine soul or the divine consciousness that is always one with its source, and it has clarity and it is confident and it is happy and it's curious and it's wholesome and it's not afraid. And mindfulness is really the ability to be able to create that separation, that differentiation between the I and all of the thoughts that are roaming and running around, maybe like roller coaster inside of me, but really that ability to create that differentiation and then even look at what's happening inside of me. And again, seeing it from the perspective of the I, which is always in a transcendent and sacred space.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me. I'm a bit of a student of the world's religions, and it's so interesting to me how different traditions narrated a bit differently, but they're talking about the same experience, exactly as you're saying, the divine spark within, or the wisdom within. And sometimes it's called the higher self. In some traditions, it's called the awareness of no self, which is a little confusing, but it's really about not being identified with all the narratives about me and whether I'm good or bad or better or worse than other people. And indeed, mindfulness practices have evolved in a lot of different traditions for precisely this purpose. And it's interesting, René Descartes, when he said, "I think, therefore I am," he was right. We construct our stories about the little me, if you will, the me that can be good or bad, successful or failure. That me we construct out of our thoughts, right? It's all these self-evaluative thoughts. Good job. Hey, you're doing a good job. That was an interesting reference to pull in, or bad
just
job.
Got a compliment. Wow, you're good.
Yeah, right. You're missing the point.
Oh, you just got criticized. You must be terrible.
Exactly. So, and we construct that actually out of the thought stream, out of all these thoughts. And one of the things that happens with mindfulness practice, as exactly as you're saying, is we develop a kind of perspective or separation where we're not identified with and believing in these narratives so much. There is a consciousness and awareness itself, which, again, in some traditions, it's seen as a divine essence, right? That's able to observe all this, able to understand all this, able to have compassion for it, right? Like the poor little, poor Ronnie, like who's running around here, trying to prove himself, trying to work out his issues with his older brother from childhood, who has perspective on all of this. And is not at all judgmental, cause really gets it that this is, this is what it is to be human. One of the really nice, kind of mindfulness related exercises, this came from Kristen Neff, who's done a lot of work on self-compassion. She suggests the next time you screw up and you're feeling really bad about it, call to mind. And we can all do this for a moment. Think of the last thing you did that you feel bad about, that felt like you screwed up. Shouldn't take long. You got it?
I have it already.
All right. There we go. You think of this thing. And now imagine that a wise, compassionate, loving friend is writing a letter to you about this thing. You've explained to them what happened and they're writing a letter. What would they say? And you can just begin with the first line or two of the letter. Because if you've had a wise, compassionate friend or a teacher, or mentor, or rabbi, we can usually imagine what they'd say, right? And what are they going to say? The first thing is going to be something like, maybe, let's start with the fact that I love you. And then let's move on to, what were the things that made this happen? Cause, I'm sure it came out of, the stresses of the situation or your history or whatever, something that understands that this is natural and human. And we all have things like this. So it's something that's about common humanity, something that's about understanding where it came from, something that's about love. And all of these together really help to diminish our preoccupation with our talking to ourselves about ourselves and our thinking and, you know, forgive me if this is, you know, I mean, it's tricky because it's different in different traditions, and I'm not sure exactly how this works out in Orthodox traditions, but the idea that one can be fundamentally good or bad from the perspective of mindfulness, no, you know, we are, you know, we have all these different parts to ourselves. You had Dick Schwartz here, I understand, just the other week, and that we all have parts of ourselves that are more noble and parts of ourselves that are less noble. But it doesn't make us fundamentally a good or bad person. We're navigating this and trying to figure out, you know, how to live in a wholesome, loving way in the world with all of this. And so all of this, it's about shifting perspective. So we're no longer believing in these narratives so much. And the nice thing is, though, that there's a technology for it, right? These practices actually do, if we do the practices regularly, they actually bring about these changes where we start to be kinder to ourselves. We start to have more perspective on this, and we start to see our common connection to other human beings.
Do you feel that if sometimes, let's say I'm having thoughts which translate into emotions that are overwhelming and they're very disturbing, maybe it's overwhelming fear or anxiety or dread or despair or frustration or negativity towards somebody or negativity towards myself, is there room to look at it and say, listen, I can have compassion about the fact that my trauma has to produce these thoughts and feelings, but really come back with another script? Because I really don't want to go into the space now. I want to remain in a place of gratitude and connection and healing and productivity.
No, absolutely. And this is one of the interesting dances, I think, in almost all healing traditions, right? How much should we open to and give space for the pain? Because we can't just gloss over the pain or do a spiritual bypass and just jump into, no, I'm actually all about love when I'm actually crying inside. But at the same time, we need to have resources, right? And we need to resource ourselves so that we have the capacity to bear the pain as well as the capacity to engage in positive, productive, loving, meaningful ways in the world that are an antidote to the pain. Things like you mentioned, you know, gratitude throughout the day as part of Judaic practice. Absolutely. You know, the secular scientists studying this stuff say the most powerful intervention you can do for well-being across the board in the kind of field of positive psychology of looking for, you know, what contributes to well-being is gratitude practice, noticing what you have. And, I actually have a particular thought about why gratitude practices are so powerful. And I think it's because they do two things simultaneously. One is, instead of focusing on a sense of deficit or need or what I don't have, we notice what we do have and through appreciation. But the other is when we're grateful, we're usually grateful towards someone or towards something or toward an entity. It could be gratitude toward God. It could be gratitude toward another human being who has done something. We could be gratitude toward an aspect of nature. It could be gratitude, but it's gratitude towards something outside of ourselves, which starts to form this sense of connection. And it's when we can move from preoccupation with me to experiencing ourselves as part of something larger than me. Mm. All sorts of growth, healing, and good things come from that.
Our brains were wired to be attached, to be connected.
Totally.
I'm going to ask, you know, from a perspective of somebody who's a real trauma victim and they're in a lot of pain, and suddenly you're telling them, start practicing gratitude.
Yeah, good point.
No, there's nothing for me to be grateful for. What are you talking about? Do you know what I'm dealing with?
If I can add to Tova's question, just to put it into the mix, and that is this person who's, let's call it, an active trauma, they may not even know that they're an active trauma. Their very eye that is listening to what you're saying is filled with trauma. So when I'm trying to be mindful and practice mindfulness, it's the trauma doing it.
Yeah.
So the mindfulness itself is a trauma exercise. How does one extricate themselves from that loop.
Yeah. You know, there, under the umbrella of mindfulness practice are actually a lot of different practices. And depending on what's happening at the moment, one or another might be more suited to our growth, development, and healing. When we're completely overwhelmed with pain, we want to build up the side of the equation, which is the resource, which is the ability to tolerate the difficulty that's happening. Maybe something really horrible has happened. Obviously, something really horrible has happened in Israel, right? And there's tremendous amount of pain, completely understandable and unavoidable. I don't mean that what happened was unavoidable, but the pain in response to what happened, if you're human, you're going to feel this, right? So then what to do, you know, under those circumstances? And in moments like that, that may not be the moment to, you know, start just being with the breath and feeling the feelings, because the feelings may be volcanic at, you know, at this moment. And my sense of ability to bear it may be quite small. And we don't want to re-traumatize ourselves by, you know, by feeling even more overwhelmed with these practices. But there are other things that we can do. We can do, you know, various kinds of, you know, step back and think, okay, so what helps me to feel soothed, comforted, a little safer, a little nicer toward myself? And, you know, and it may be connection to caring friends or family that we feel safe with. It could be connection to scripture that is meaningful to us and is comforting to us. It could be, you know, physical exercise to do something about, you know, all the tension that's in the body. It could be really taking care around nutrition for a while. And let me take good care of this vessel. And when we're doing sort of mindfulness practices in this context, if somebody's overwhelmed with a lot of feeling, I wouldn't advise them to sit and follow the breath this way. I'd suggest they do something like nature meditation, where you go out for a walk, you know, bring your attention to just the moment-to-moment sensations of the feet on the ground, and look up and look at the trees, look at the clouds, look at the sky. The mind is going to go off into all of the thoughts about all the bad things that have happened, the fears, the, you know, anger, or the mind will spin out. And instead of gently bringing the attention back to the breath, we just try to come back to the trees. We try to come back to something a little bit more vivid. This is, again, assuming the neighborhood feels safe and it's okay to do this, but, you know, something that is going to help us to feel more resourced, because there's always this ratio between the intensity of the experience we're trying to bear and our sense of our capacity to bear it, our sense of resource, being resourced. And the big mistake the trauma treatment field made years ago, many years ago, decades ago, was thinking, okay, well, let's help people process the difficult thing that's happened without thinking about, does this person have sufficient resources to do this right now? And, you know, what we've learned over time is resources first, then you dip into what's more difficult. But mindfulness practice can be very helpful on the resourcing end, because it can help us take refuge in the present moment, in actually tasting a meal, for example, and realizing, oh, food is still wholesome, even though the world is on fire.
It sounds like what you're describing is baby steps to mindfulness.
Yeah, right? Or using different kinds of mindfulness practices under different situations. Some are going to help us get in touch with what's really going on inside. Others are going to ground us in the present moment and help us have a little bit more space from the incessant and troubling and upsetting thoughts. So it's more a matter of choosing which medicine, if you will, is more suited to this particular moment in time, and being flexible about it.
Mm-hmm. I think I want to jump back to the gratitude one, if you want to just, you know, speak about that a little more. Because, you know, even in my own journey, I think like gratitude is like, it's like the candy, like everybody talks about, like, just start practicing that gratitude and you're going to heal. Like, that's like the ideal, like, jump into gratitude. And I, in my journey, I still struggle. Why should I, you know, there's so many things. Why should I be grateful for this? And how do I be grateful for that? Yeah. Like, I feel like there's a lot of resentment towards that. I don't, even when we hear it fresh start, like, It's not.
Maybe,
it's
can
not
I,
the most
can I give a Jewish answer, Tova? Can I give a Jewish answer?
Sure, sure.
With the permission of Dr. Sigurd, I want to. You know, I think maybe the one of the deepest and most powerful forms of gratitude we can practice, and also people who have a lot of trauma, is gratitude to yourself. Gratitude to your soul. Gratitude to the beautiful, beautiful inner child who has seen so much pain, who has endured so much disappointment, who has maybe experienced real abuse, maybe of the worst forms of abuse, and maybe by people we trusted so, so much. And despite all of that, you have here a person who's committed to heal, who's good. You haven't inflicted that damage to other people. At least you try to be an innocent person. Your soul was present. Your soul even seeing it happen and yet remained innocent and sacred and pure and holy and good. Wow, that's a lot of gratitude. That's a lot of gratitude to yourself, towards your beautiful, beautiful neshama, soul.
That's beautiful and very important. And, you know, just to empathize with what you're saying, Tova, you know, some of the, I loathe generalizations, but some of this is cultural. And so I come from a relatively secular New York Jewish background, right? And in learning these different practices, it's been very interesting. And I thought in my entire childhood, do I remember anybody in my community saying, I feel so blessed? No, not a lot of that. You know, a lot of you think you've got Soros. I've got Soros. This is what just my personal experience. And it's interesting, you know, crossing paths with other
people. Are your parents American or?
Yeah. Yeah. American, but close enough. My mom was born in Europe and, my dad's parents were, but it's interesting, right? That there are cultures in which people, I think, you know, history shapes this, right? And it shapes what comes readily to us. And this is not to say that gratitude isn't enormously important, but there may be more obstacles in the way in some cultural contexts than in other cultural contexts.
Well, Jews carry a lot of trauma. I don't have to tell you.
Right. Yeah. So it was basically because of that. So, you know, it's always complicated. It's always honoring what is, right? Honoring the fact that there's this feeling of no, you know, or I sometimes kid when teaching loving kindness practices, which are, a way to, through imagination, generate compassion, and caring toward others. You know, sometimes what emerges is the inner Darth Vader, right? Like what comes out, you know, you start trying to generate love and you feel nothing but cynicism. You feel not, you know, the opposite shows up. And the interesting dance to my mind is how to honor that, realize, okay, this is part of the mix. You know, this is part of who I am, even while experimenting with the possibility that there might be another pathway, because I do think fundamentally, if we can heal our hurts sufficiently, we do experience gratitude and we can connect to gratitude, and cultivating that is enormously helpful because we have a lot of different instincts, some of which are more deserving of cultivation than others in terms of our well-being. And, you know, it's a balance. We both recognizing what is, honoring it, working with pain, and trying to cultivate these attitudes and ways of being that are associated with well-being for ourselves and others.
I think I have found, and I think, Tovia, you're touching on this so acutely, and that is that one of the most catastrophic and painful consequences of trauma is that it is so hard to experience viscerally gratitude and love.
Yeah.
It's so difficult. The trauma wants to rob us from it. The trauma wants to say, I am miserable. Life is miserable. Everything is miserable. My past, present, and future are miserable. My brain is miserable. My heart is miserable. And of course, it also deprives us from love.
And I'm listening to you, Rabbi YY, and I'm thinking to myself, this should be your answer because I'm not the rabbinical person here. But what does Judaism start with every single day? Modani. And like what you just said about thanking the inner child, what's the content of Modani? You could take over and talk if you want to talk about it.
Dr. Siegel might know this. In the Jewish tradition, it's fascinating. It's an amazing tradition. The first thing a Jew does when he or she opens their eyes, literally before brushing my teeth, going to the bathroom, checking my phone, pressing snooze on my alarm clock, that comes afterwards. But the first thing a Jew ought to do when they wake up in the morning, that's what Jewish tradition says, you open your eyes and we do a meditation or a form of gratitude of 12 words in Hebrew. 12 words, takes 12 seconds. It's called Modani in Hebrew, whatever language it is. And the content is, I thank you. I thank you, eternal and enduring King and universal consciousness, for returning to me my soul with compassion. And great and abundant is your trust in me. And literally, it's before even going to the bathroom.
Yeah, that's great. It's great. No, I was co-leading a mindfulness retreat. The subtext was cultivating joy. It was for psychotherapists this summer, and we began every morning, the first morning meditation, with good news. We woke up. This is really impressive. We woke up, which is just a small, it's just a little piece of the 12 words that you've got here. But
12 words, literally.
Every 1-year-old starts saying that. Our kids know that at one.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
the challenge is when we have trauma to experience it viscerally.
Yeah.
Not just to say it, but to really, really feel it, be able to breathe it and then live it.
I'll share with you something
that takes work.
I'll share with you something that's a little, from the esoterica of the trauma treatment world. But since I know you've had Bessel van der Kolk and Dick Schwartz as part of the series, and they're both, good friends and colleagues of mine. And, I was in a discussion with both of them, about this fundamental question of, is our capacity for love, connection, wisdom, compassion, is it innate and always there and just has to be tapped into, or need it be cultivated developmentally? In other words, do you have to grow up in an environment which is sufficiently loving and caring in order to have these qualities? And it's a really huge question in understanding trauma, and it's a huge question for all of us, I think, as human beings. And it's interesting, and I'll tell you the context, and I hope this doesn't sound too avant-garde for you, but one of the things that both Bessel van der Kolk and Dick Schwartz are involved in is the burgeoning field of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And Bessel, who's quite the expert in these matters, said, I've been converted, because Dick, with his sense of what he probably spoke about of self, which is his word for what, Rabbi, you were describing as this divine, inner, untarnishable consciousness. Dick's position has always been, it's there. You just got to get the other parts out of the way that are blocking it. And Bessel was more like, I think you got to cultivate this, over time. And what happens is people with really horrible trauma histories and really horrible developmental histories who really didn't get the love that every human being absolutely deserves will have these encounters under the influence of these medicines, not willy-nilly. This is not a polemic, go out and, take psychedelics, but in this carefully structured therapeutic protocol where they like suddenly say, oh, now I know what love is. Oh, now I see what safety is. Suggesting that, yeah, it is there. It is there. But as the rabbi saying, a lot of stuff, a lot of injuries can get in the way and can hide it.
I told Dr. Schwartz last week when we were together, I said, in Kabbalah, in Jewish mysticism and spirituality, one of the two most popular words to speak about the human challenge, one is klipa. Klipa means that the soul is covered with shells and husks, and you have to pierce through literally the husks to allow the light to shine. Mm-hmm. And the second word that's very common is the experience of spiritual and emotional exile. where the soul is, the heart is exiled. It's in a prison, and we have to work daily to remove the shackles and break down the doors.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Yeah,
I asked Wessel van der Kolk when we had a session. I asked, you know, he was describing himself as a real atheist. So I asked him, I said, I want to ask you a question. After all the trauma and pain and PTSD and horrors you have seen 50 years or 55 years, have you become cynical? And do you ever become cynical? Like, you know, this is just a crazy world. It would have been much better if the Big Bang would have had different results and nobody would suffer. And he looked at me and he said, when I don't become cynical because I have seen the resilience of my patients and seeing that after crazy stories, there's an inner voice that is incredibly, incredibly loving and powerful.
Yeah.
Despite everything that happened. So I said, but one second, if a person is just a machine, when you break a machine, it gets destroyed. You don't expect that inside the machine, there's some soulful chip who's watching the abuse and could come back. He says, So I said, so maybe you're not such an atheist. Maybe you're not such an atheist after all. Just rethink that. So I wanted to ask you, does all your practice and all the exercises, you know, growing up, as you spoke about your Jewish heritage, how does that impacted your spiritual sense of life?
Well, you know, faith? I'll tell you the truth. The truth is I grew up kind of rational, positive materialist. And, you know, so I'm 69 years old. I grew up in New York. I grew up among like the counterculture and hippies. And I wound up taking psychedelics at a young age. And I had some experiences with psychedelics that I thought the only people who describe this stuff are religious masters. I want to learn about them. And I actually majored in religion as an undergraduate, even though I was a secular guy without, I had been bar mitzvahed and stuff, but I didn't understand the spiritual side of the tradition at all, as a kid. And, that was my opening to it. And then, I've always been interested in multiple pathways, but they're pathways to very parallel understandings as best I can glean, that include Kabbalistic, pathways, of exactly the stuff that you're describing, that there, you know, there is this human, I relate to it a little bit more as the human capacity for love, the human capacity for wisdom and compassion. I think of it more in those terms than I think of it in terms of a God that would be external in some way. It's more like the God that's in all of us is my personal way of understanding this.
Well, that's the Jewish mystical idea.
Yeah.
There's God in every single one.
And I live 3 miles from Walden Pond, and you know, there was Thoreau talking about God and, you know, in the loons, in the pond.
What did the psychedelics show you, if I may? How did they create that shift?
I had what we call a non-dual experience. You know, suddenly I went through a sort of series of stages, the first of which is a kind of softening of repression barrier so that a lot of personal unconscious material coming up, you know, memories, fears, you know, the kind of stuff that is the meat and potatoes of psychoanalysis, if you will. And then kind of a lot of mythical kinds of imagery, if you will, a kind of Jungian version. And then it all cleared out. And there was just this sense of peace and interconnectedness and no sense of me. There was simply the sense of consciousness. And it was like, as they say, it had a noetic quality. It felt inherently true in some way. And then it was like, okay, well, I'm not going to take drugs all the time and you can't function in the world well under the influence of these drugs. Who knows about this and how do you cultivate this kind of awareness? And it was, you know, meditation masters, whether from Kabbalistic traditions or Zen traditions or yogic tradition, you know, these are the folks who have been investigating how do you shift consciousness to have this awareness. And that's been the backdrop to my whole career as a psychologist, is this kind of, you know, understanding of, you know, what's possible in terms of perspective and awareness. You know, there are people who can be extremely religiously observant who don't have much of a sense of what the spiritual underpinnings might be of their tradition, not just in Judaism, and, you know, in many different traditions, where the idea of sort of following the rules that I've been taught and doing the things that help me to identify with my community, that's central. And whatever that has to do with psychological growth and transformation or spiritual transformation simply hasn't been part of the, their experience. And when people who have had that as a significant part of their life experience, and they've been in pain and they start to heal from the pain, whether it's through a more secular psychological pathway or a more spiritual, pathway, where here I'm emphasizing spiritual as opposed to religious forms and structures, they can get upset, like, wait a minute, what about, you know, what was all that about? And or in fact, you know, sometimes aspects of the religious structures, when interpreted in certain ways, contribute to people's suffering. I mean, how many people think God's punishing them in the world? Now, you know, that's an interesting vision of God, if you think he's punishing you, but a lot of people are suffering from this, right? And when they heal psychologically, they say, wait, forget that. The religion, that made me feel I was a bad person. That was not helpful. And indeed, that aspect of it wasn't helpful. And then eventually, as you're saying, they circle back. They may start to see the wisdom of spiritual teachings. And then they may start to notice, oh, these religious forms were actually originally designed for this spiritual purpose, even though the way I got it from my parents or wherever I got it from, you know, turned it into self-torture and it wasn't helpful. So I think there are those pathways. And sometimes people don't come back to religion. They just say, to heck with that. And I'm not talking about Judaism in particular. You see this in all sorts of, you know, people who've grown up with traditions where the religious structures weren't that helpful. They were helpful for participating in community and teaching them ethical rules and all of that, but they weren't that helpful for psychological growth and healing. And it's, you know, it is so interesting to me how in virtually all of the world's religious traditions, there were great sages of one sort or another who had great insights into the nature of human suffering and its alleviation. And then others later who didn't really understand it took outer forms of what they said or suggested, rigidified it, and it wound up being helpful in terms of ethics and social organization and communities and all, but not so helpful in terms of people's psychological journeys. And then somebody later has to re-recognize the spark, the spiritual spark that was there that underpinned all those structures and, you know, and help people connect to it again. So I think, Tova, what you're talking about is really, really important, in that people can kind of recognize themselves at all sorts of stages along that journey.
So Rabbi Wywy, you know, I think you obviously deal with adult survivors of extreme trauma and pain and abuse. And I think the journey that Tova mentioned that we see oftentimes at fresh start, you know, it's mamish, it's machadish, it's like literally renewing their connection. It reminds me of the story of Levi Yitzchak Berdichev. The same God you don't believe in, he told the atheist, the same God you don't believe in.
Like the seagull, it's a great story. A Jew came to one of the great Hasidic masters, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, and he spoke to him about the soul, about purpose, about the creator. So he says, Rabbi, you got the wrong guy. I don't believe in God. So he looked at him and he said these words. He said, the God you don't believe in, I also don't believe in.
Yeah, perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I think you know what Dr. Siegel is teaching us here, and I think it gets to the core of the issue, and that is so many of us have been raised, or as a result of life's experiences, we have completely experienced a terribly distorted form of faith, religion, tradition, God, spirituality, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sabbath, holidays, mitzvahs, bar mitzvah, bas mitzvah, completely not only devoid of spiritual enlightenment, but sometimes the exact opposite, used as an excuse for dysfunction, for trauma, and never mind sometimes for even abuse, covered up and camouflaged by the fear of God or the fear of parents or the fear of punishment or hell or paradise. And I think we owe it to ourselves and our children and the future of our people and the world to usher in the age of healing, the age of real healing, of real enlightenment, by discovering what Judaism has always taught for thousands of years. And I think it's very important for people to know that we don't only have a right to pursue all avenues of healing, we have a moral obligation to pursue it. We weren't created to suffer and be miserable. We were created to be happy, to be blissful, to be full of love and light. In our tradition, we were created to bring Mashiach, to bring redemption to the world, to our souls, to the world. How do we do that? Not by being miserable. So I think, you know, people are often said, you know, this is not for you. This is not for you. You know, suffer forever. I find it disheartening when some people who are not suffering tell others, this may not be a path for you. There are so many avenues today towards healing. There's so many methods that have been developed with a responsible, we're talking about in a responsible way, as Dr. Siegel said, you know, in a responsible way with the right people monitoring and integration and using, you know, methods that have been tested and can be helpful. Everyone is deserving of opening the gates of redemption.
Yeah. I want to be mindful of your time, doctor. I just want to also, Rabbi Weiwei, you can translate. Rabbi Russell always mentions that Torah, Judaism, our religion, David HaMelech says, Derecha Darchei Noam, V'chol Nesiva Seha Shalom. How do you translate the Rabbi Weiwei?
It's in the Book of Psalms by King David. There's a very powerful line. By the way, that book I have always found as one of the most healing works. King David suffered terribly. He writes, my father and mother abandoned me and God took me. And I think that's why Jews loved Psalms. It's a very, very honest and vulnerable and book filled with courage and resilience and honesty. So there's a line there I'm sorry. I was mixing up with another line. In Psalms, it says, Tamuru ketoiv Hashem, taste and you will see that God is good. That means if God equals evil or horrors, it's not God. It's called idolatry. Right. It's paganism. There's another verse in Proverbs that's by King Solomon, King David's son. He speaks about Torah and he says, its paths are the paths of pleasantness and its ways are the ways of peace. The entire Torah was given to create harmony in the world. So, yeah, that's, I think, another...
So, in wrapping up, Dr. Ron, I think this has been enlightening. Rabbi Weiwei, I think it's, you know, just one last point maybe you want to touch on in your closing remarks, Rabbi Weiwei, is we got this question, and obviously the word mindfulness sometimes brings up thoughts of Eastern religions and things that are don't coincide with our Torah values. Perhaps, Rabbi Weiwei, as you help wrap this up, you could just, you know, share a little bit of thoughts on the integration between mindfulness and Yiddishkeit and Torah, and then, you know.
And may I just say one word about that? It is true that of the many cultures in the world that have developed mindfulness practices, particularly certain Buddhist traditions have refined them to a great degree. In other words, you have situations where monks have practiced, you know, the sort of magical 50,000 hours of experience that gives one some knowledge about something. And they've written about it in a lot of detail. And it's true that Western psychologists have often adapted, methods from there, but the traditions that they're adapting it from are, you know, surprisingly agnostic about cosmologies and what we might think of as theologies. You know, the Buddha was, you know, famously people would ask him like religious questions of various sorts. And he famously said, you know, if a man comes to me with an arrow piercing his arm and he starts asking me from what tree was hewn the wood of that arrow and from what bird came those feathers, I'd say, this is not the point. The point is, how can we get the arrow out? How can we alleviate suffering here and heal this guy? And he said, I'm a physician of the mind. I teach about, you know, the cause of psychological suffering and its alleviation, which, and in the same way that a good Jew, I think, could use an antibiotic to heal an infection and think, thank God somebody, perhaps a Jew, invented the antibiotic. I think we can, I think it may be okay to borrow healing methodologies that have been developed in all sorts of parts of the world. Just that's my.
Not only that, this is fascinating discussion. In 1978, one of the greatest leaders of the Jewish world and thinkers, known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, wrote a confidential memo to many, many Jewish psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists that he was connected with, and he asked them a personal favor. He said, there are enormous amounts of Jewish youths who can use mindfulness and meditation practices from the East for healing in terms of anxiety, in terms of alleviating the stress, in terms of finding, you know, more inner contentment, etc. But the challenge is it's completely intertwined with many of the, you know, pagan or idolatry practices. At least, can they please start developing these practices in a way that's suitable for the entire Jewish world, both secular Jews and religious Jews and Orthodox Jews? And then in 1979, he gave a seminal public address about this in July 1979, addressing this at length. And the main point was that medical technique, just like antibiotic, as Dr. Siegel just said, you know, advancements in therapy and science and physics, today we could say in plant medicines, et cetera, all must be studied and observed as to see how they can benefit people with trauma, people with depression, people with anxiety, people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and what have you. And we shouldn't remain shackled by rigid philosophies that don't allow people to benefit from all the blessings in God's world. There's so many methods that could be used in a proper way, in a Torah-oriented way, in a spiritually enlightened way, and it's our responsibility. Yep.
You may find it amusing from the other side. I was at a conference at Emory University years ago. It was the Dalai Lama talking to researchers and clinicians studying depression. It was this really big conference about meditation practices and psychotherapy. And the Dalai Lama said, look, I have one request for all of you. He's saying at the end of the thing, just one thing that's really important to me. People said, what is it? He said, if you can discover that some of the methods that have been developed in my tradition are actually useful for depression, for anxiety, for these kinds of disorders, please, please don't tell anybody that they have connections to Buddhism, because the whole point of my tradition is alleviating suffering and improving happiness and love in the world. And if you tell people it comes from Buddhism, some people are not going to try it. So please leave that out. So it's interesting from both sides. You have a, you know, maybe it's okay.
Right. And ultimately, you know, from the Jewish perspective, and Dr. Siegel referred to it really, you know, it's something that's universal, and that's what Judaism taught. You know, at the core of our faith is that there is oneness. We were all conceived in oneness. There's no duality. We are all particular manifestations of the infinite oneness, which we call God, which we call Hashem. And each of us is a channel of that infinite light through our particular life. And every mitzvah in Judaism, whether it's wrapping tefillin or putting a mezuzah on the door or Shabbat or whatever it is, giving charity, it's all a method to connect to that oneness. And that's what healing is. Healing is the moment when I can identify and breathe in that oneness which is the source of all love and all connection and all empathy and all compassion, and I think all bliss. So, yes. So in Judaism, healing and religion are so deeply connected. When we can divorce the religion from, unfortunately, the negative experiences that we have been taught, that we have experienced, and when we can do that, it can be blissful.
Well, I'd like to. I guess we're going to take this opportunity. Thank you, Dr. Siegel, for joining us. First of all, I think I know what your secret touch is. Your voice is so soothing. That and Kinainahar at 69 to have such a great head of hair.
That's true. Okay. I just think for the historical record, it's just important to understand that in biblical times, you're talking about the first temple times. So this is, you're going back 3,000 years, okay? The Bible talks about this, about schools of prophecy, schools that trained prophets. There were hundreds of tens of thousands of Jewish prophets in the land of Israel. What was that all about, you think? What was that all about? We're not just borrowing also from others. In Judaism, there's a huge Kabbalistic, enormous tradition of meditation, of mindfulness, of silence, of prophecy. What is prophecy? Prophecy is fine-tuning the antennas in my brain to cosmic awareness, to divine consciousness. So it's just, when we go back in history, this was a major, major part of Judaism, yeah, as well.
And it really is true. Virtually every culture has developed some form of mindfulness practice. It just, the reason why they get associated in people's minds with certain Eastern traditions is because they were refined there at a very high level.
And I think they had the luxury also of retaining a continuum. Maybe they were being harassed a little less.
Absolutely.
Where they were exiled and hunted down.
There's a lot of, there was state support at many points for this kind of intensive inner investigation.
The Zohar says, the Bible says that Abraham sent his children to the east and he gave them gifts. So the Zohar, one of the oldest texts of Kabbalah, says, what were these gifts? And it says it was literally spiritual traditions. You're talking about Abraham. Yeah, I think in Buddha, right, you have one of their deities called Brahman, and they say it's connected to Abraham.
Yeah, very interesting.
An interesting theory.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Dr. Ron. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for ending what was a wild and intense and emotional 10-part webinar series. We are hope and pray that whoever's watching, whoever's gonna watch, whoever did watch will be able to take tidbits of each one of these webinars and podcasts and apply it to their life to hopefully provide healing for them, for their children, for their families. Rabbi YY, any divrei bracha before we go to wrap up the series?
I'm also going to just add one thing before you do that. If you want to try learning a little bit more meditation practices, you can go to my website. It's drronsiegel.com. And, I don't know, maybe you can post that or put it on the...
Yeah, somebody just asked me where do we learn more and what would be the first step to take if I want to enter the world of mindfulness. And
yeah, so just go to drronsiegel.com and there's all sorts of books and lots of meditations you can download for free and podcasts and things. I'm just one among many, but it's an avenue to do this.
Another whole hour learning about how to do it. We spoke about so much, what is it? And we could spend a whole nother hour just talking about what baby step to take first into this world. It was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I want to thank Dr. Siegel. I want to thank Rabbi Yochanan and Tova and Fresh Start. And I just want to encourage myself, and I think all of us who are listening now, we're going to listen later, watch later, of how powerful it is for each of us to spend time every single day, especially in the morning, to connect to our neshama, to connect to our soul, and whatever that takes on for you. But to be able to realize this is something... The soul needs oxygen. You know, when somebody's going to say, I'm so busy and I'm so overwhelmed that if I'm stopping to eat, then I'm not going to sleep anymore. We can't survive without spiritual connectedness to our truth, to our innermost soul, to Hashem. It's very hard to survive in this world. We survive, but we're not thriving, and we're not giving to the people and to the world and to ourselves what we're supposed to be giving. So I think we learn from this. You know, there's so much that we could learn individually and give this to our children and our loved ones to be able to spend time every day in that inner spiritual connection with our souls, with our inner experience, with our innermost truth, with our light, with our love, and radiate that to everyone we come in contact with. And I think our children especially, well, our homes become much, much more powerful and beautiful places, our marriages and our inner happiness and our world. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you, Dr. Siegel. We'll do this again. So thank you, YY. Take care, everybody. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This class is brought to you by the yeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. Make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.